it's just very, paying bond is an arduous process for families that usually don't have the money to pay. But even if they did, it's extremely difficult to pay. One has to have some sort of documentation in order to pay bonds.
Thanks, Carl.
The office to pay bonds are out and so forth.
Carl, I gotta move, Carl. But I thank you so very much. Appreciate the information you've shared. Appreciate your insight. We will make sure that folks know how to reach you or follow you and your work. If you could give us a Twitter handle, we'd appreciate that before we close out.
Sure. Visit us online at brooklynbailfund.org, or you can follow me on Twitter at Carlken, C-A-R-L-K-E-N. Thanks so much for having me, Nana.
Thank you. Sorry for having to cut you off. I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Nikki was unable to join us today, folks, but we hope to bring her on the show in the future. I'd like to thank all of today's guests and the entire Sojourner Truth team, host and producer Margaret Prescott, assistant producer Ramiro Funes, and audio engineer Federico Garcia. Thank you.
Radio.
KBOO's fall membership drive will kick off September 15th, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. KBOO is non-commercial, independent, and community-supported radio, one of the most democratic forms of media. During the drive, we'll feature content focused on democracy throughout the radio day. On September 15th, the Old Mole Variety Hour will look at democracy through the lens of cultural work, how the arts like music, photography, theater, and fiction raise up the voices of those too often silenced by the corporate media. As a premium for KBOO donors, the Moles are offering prints of Betty Lee's photography, which document two decades of activists in the streets of Portland. For details, visit the Old Mole webpage on kboo.fm. And thanks for your support. Music by Hanto Beatmaker.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hey KBOO members, it's time once again to vote and make your voices heard. KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election is coming up on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. KBOO members are invited to participate in a lively discussion on how to reconnect KBOO's diverse communities after 18 months of the pandemic, the role of radio in the 21st century, and the upcoming celebration of our 54th anniversary. KBOO depends on its members to help shape its operations and programming. So show your support by casting your vote and joining this community forum. Be sure to check your mailbox for your ballot and voting information. If you don't receive your ballot in the mail by September 13th, please contact the membership department or vote online at kboo.fm. Ballots cast by mail must be received by Friday, September 24th. The deadline to vote electronically is September 19th. And will reopen during the annual meeting in lieu of voting in person. If you are not a member, you can become one today by going to kboo.fm and clicking the Join Now button. Again, that's KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information about the annual meeting, candidate bios, and online voting forms can be found at kbu.fm/meeting2021. That's kbu.fm/meeting2021.
Many students who left for spring break in March of 2020 are only now returning to in-person school for the first time this fall.
Today, Richmond Public Schools extended the closures until at least April 13th. In a letter sent to parents, the superintendent announced the district...
Oh, yeah, a little longer. They're deciding what they're going to do, Sheba. And today marks the end of spring break for most Metro Atlanta school districts. Atlanta Public Schools going fully virtual this week. The superintendent...
It might sound nice in theory, time away from the classroom, but schooling never stopped, and it was hard. And imagine what virtual class was like for five-year-olds.
Guys, what happened?
She left the meeting.
Yeah, she left the meeting.
It kicked her out the internet.
Yeah.
You guys see me? Mm-hmm.
All of you guys, I see that there's a little record sign at the top of the screen.
Kind of cute, kind of a nightmare. From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today on the show, the kids are back in school. Online school was hard enough technically, but it was also tough mentally. Many college students scrolled through their pain using TikTok. But in the new school year, will they hang on to their digital coping habits? And should they? With Good Reason's Cassie Deering has that story.
For college student Faith Deering, the biggest pitfall of online school was not having a chair.
Imagine a square cubed ottoman and then the floor and me, and that's it.
Faith, who, full disclosure, is my sister, is a student at Ole Miss. In spring 2020, Ole Miss went virtual, which meant Faith was taking classes from her bedroom floor.
After about the second hour of me, you know, constantly being on my computer, it hits me, oh wait, I haven't gotten up and used my legs in 2 hours. Let's get up. And then when I try to get up, I hear my knees crack. And when I get up, it's like, oof, that hurt.
Location matters if you're doing online school. Even if students have a good chair and a desk, it's often the people they're living with who make up their daily distractions.
Another thing that was kind of distracting at first was my family. No offense. They sometimes would like pop their heads in during my online Zoom classes, and I would have to, you know, look away from the screen, and my teacher would be like, who's there? And I'd be like, nobody. So now I, every time I have a Zoom class, I usually put a chair in between the doorway that, you know, separates the room that I use for Zoom classes and the rest of the house.
Maya Neer, an intern at With Good Reason, was also battling through Zoom classes from her childhood bedroom.
So the first week of online classes, I would still like sit at my desk and like have my camera on and that kind of stuff. And then a lot of my peers started like having their camera off, and I assume kind of just like staying in bed more and like more informal.
By the end of the day, Maya says she usually had a horrible headache.
And I would just feel really tired and also kind of like frustrated with myself. Like, I haven't like moved at all today. And it was hard because even after the last Zoom call, I still had like homework and stuff to do on my computer. So it never felt like I was really done.
When Maya finally closed her laptop, she was in a really bad mood.
And I would just go the 2 feet from my desk to my bed and lie in my bed and watch TikTok probably.
TikTok. It's probably the biggest name in today's internet culture. You can find just about anything on TikTok. Cottagecore DIYs, travel hacks, Mozart trap remixes. All you have to do is scroll. And for those struggling to find motivation in their lives, it's a bright light in a never-ending Zoom day.
My TikTok is generally pretty positive, I think. So like a lot of babies and like baby animals, that kind of stuff.
At the same time, some students have been spending too many hours on the app. Opening TikTok has become something of a bad habit, maybe even an addiction.
Basically, I got really addicted to TikTok right at the beginning of the pandemic. It was just like a constant source of entertainment. And usually I would just go on it before bed or during a break in between classes. But then sometimes I'd get like really glued to it and would watch it during class or like even during like little breaks, which is bad.
How many hours were you spending on it?
I don't know. I should probably look on my phone, but I'm kind of scared to. I think at its worst, probably like 3 hours a day.
We know that many people have been turning a lot to social media during this time.
This is Bethany Teachman, a clinical psychologist and director of clinical studies at the University of Virginia. She says time on TikTok isn't necessarily bad.
TikTok has inspired all kinds of great dances. There are a lot of really valuable social justice movements that have been really promoted on TikTok in important ways. I know my own children have found that a really valuable source of connection in some ways during this time.
But it's important to consider what you're giving up when you spend hours scrolling.
So if you're spending so much time on social media that you're not getting good sleep, you're not exercising, you're not getting outside, and you're not having any live interactions with people, it's probably going to have some negative effects. If, on the other hand, it's part of a more balanced lifestyle that includes doing things to stay productive, doing things that are relaxing, doing things that are fun, doing exercise, getting good sleep, all of that mix of healthy activities that we need to have, then social media is probably going to be playing a more positive role.
Teachman says that monitoring your social media use doesn't have to be a pain. You can think of it like a game.
So if you are wondering whether you're spending too much time on social media, monitor your mood based on how much time you're spending and see if there is a relationship and then play with it. So we have to sort of treat ourselves as almost, you know, doing mini science experiments where we track what's going on and kind of see the effect, because there isn't going to be a one size fits all solution of how to manage this time. It's going to be some trial and error, and you're going to want to see the effect of different things that you try and keep the stuff that works well for you.
If you're turning to social media to manage stress or anxiety, Teachman says there are probably better tools for that, including Mind Trails, a brain training tool she's developed.
Which is designed to help people think in less rigidly catastrophic ways. So we know that when people are vulnerable to anxiety, they have a tendency to kind of assume the worst in a situation. So if there's uncertainty, they're going to think, wow, this is going to turn out really, really badly and I won't be able to cope with it. That type of catastrophic thinking is very common in anxiety. And so we want to help people break that a little bit so they can think more flexibly and realize that situations can turn out in lots of different ways.
That kind of stress management will be key as students return to in-person schooling. In our virtual conversation, Faith Deering imagined what it will be like to be back in the classroom at Ole Miss.
I would have packed all my supplies and books and preparations and syllabi the night before in my backpack, and then I would go downstairs to my dorm's cafeteria and then get some food, say hi to the lunch ladies, and then out I go into the blistering sun.
Between welcome weeks and basketball games, Faith would find herself reconnecting with friends and communities. But she still has reservations about fall 2021.
Even though I'm vaccinated, I still feel a bit nervous just because I don't know who else around me is or is not vaccinated, because a lot of people in the South do not really want to be vaccinated, and I don't want to be affected or have my family be affected by it.
Maya's also catching up on the things she missed last year. She's decided to focus on what matters to her, friends and meaningful internships. But that doesn't leave much room for TikTok.
A lot of the work is stuff I want to be doing, like not school that I'm feeling like super stressed out about. So I don't feel like I need as much of a stress relief or like distraction. And I've just been like with family and friends a lot more often because the pandemic is getting better here. I guess I'm like less lonely, so I don't have to watch TikTok as much. That's like super depressing.
Whether time on TikTok is depressing or an antidepressant might depend on who's scrolling. But with the world opening up, it's no surprise that trendy dances, dank memes, and online rants are fading into the background. That's okay, just as long as there's always a place for cute animal videos. For With Good Reason, I'm Cassie Deering.
We've all heard the horror stories about teaching. Teachers don't make enough, they're overworked. But then in March of 2020, thanks to the pandemic, they got labeled heroes. But the celebrating may have been too little too late, Brad Bazell is a professor of educational leadership at Radford University. He says the lack of autonomy for teachers in their classrooms is compounding with bad pay, and now the educational field is losing its best recruiters, current teachers. Brad, there's a shortage of young people wanting to enter the teaching field. What do you think is most responsible for that? What factors seem to be driving that?
Well, money does matter. The teaching profession has never been highly paid, and for folks who are choosing their careers and they're looking at spending tens of thousands of dollars on a college education, they look at money. But money's not the top factor. People want to go into teaching because they want to make a difference in the lives of children. You know, for decades, that's why we chose to be teachers. But what we have seen in our education system over the last 20 years, and what all of our young people have experienced for their entire K-12 career, is a different education system, one that's been driven by high-stakes testing for accountability purposes. And at one time, I'm a former principal, and as a principal, when I would interview folks who wanted to be teachers, many of them would speak of being the children of teachers, and their so that they had grown up among educators and therefore wanted to be an educator, or they've spoken about teachers that they had who inspired them and encouraged them to be a teacher. And what we have today are teachers in the classroom telling their students, don't be a teacher. You don't want to do this for the rest of your life. We have parents who are teachers telling their children, I'm not going to pay for you to go to college if you're going to be a teacher. So we have created a system over the last 20 years that has, as I was reading recently, a line, it says, we have taken all the joy out of teaching.
Was there a time early in your career where you experienced the joy of teaching and then a period later where you saw that joy made difficult to achieve?
Yes. And you know, from the beginning, I have loved teaching. I have had that joy of teaching. I was actually a career switcher. 35 years ago, I had a business degree and had worked out in the insurance industry for about 4 years. And as I said at that time, I wanted a job that mattered, where at the end of the day, at the end of my life, it will have mattered the work that I did. And so I quit my job. I went back to school, got my teaching certificate, and took a substantial pay cut and never regretted that decision once. And still today, as a teacher of teachers who aspire to be school leaders, I still have that joy in teaching. But I can distinctly remember as a principal in the early 2000s, all the work that we would do the entire school year would be boiled down to a 50-question multiple choice test in reading, in math, in history, and in science. And the scores on those tests were all that mattered to the public. That's what was going to have our school labeled as successful or failing. I don't know of anyone who wants to be in a school that's labeled as failing.
You couldn't have known back then that this was the beginning of something that would last for decades. This was born of the No Child Left Behind initiative?
It was. They began writing the law in 2001, and it was actually enacted in 2002 in the George Bush administration. There were many of us, and myself included, who looked at the law as it was written and said, there's no way this will last. This will be gone 2-3 years max, and it will be over with. But what happened is it didn't go away. And the next administration, the first Obama administration, kind of doubled down on that same idea of high-stakes testing as being the driver for school improvement. The Race to the Top legislation that came out of the Obama administration not only required testing of students, but it required that the testing of students be calculated into each teacher's performance evaluation. So as if the teachers didn't have enough stress to begin with, we added that additional piece on.
Help me understand why we were so motivated to leave No Child Behind. I mean, that does sound like a good idea. What had driven this?
It's a great idea. Who wants to leave a child behind? I don't know a single person who wants to leave a child behind, but I certainly don't know a single educator in our public schools who wants to leave children behind. But we have to really go back to 1983 as the genesis of a lot of this. A report was released called A Nation at Risk. And in that report, that it was an indictment of our public school system. The primary basis for that indictment was the United States standing on international test scores. But what most people didn't understand at that time, and still don't understand today, is in the United States, we are one of the few education systems in the world that educates every single child. We turn no child away. We bring them all into our public schools. And accordingly, we test all of our children. The countries that we were losing to in those international tests were countries that only educated their top students. And they, accordingly, they only tested their top students. So we had all of our students competing against a small top tier of students from other countries.
Conversely, however, there have been moment after moment in the intervening years where, like, why Johnny can't read, or concerns about are we warehousing public school students, or a mind is a terrible thing to waste, right? This idea that some students were languishing in classes, that it wasn't about the race to the top so much as who are we leaving behind? What solution might we have come up with that would be less stressful on teachers, but still bring everybody along?
So since I've thrown rocks at No Child Left Behind, I will also make a positive statement about it. What you're talking about right now is the one thing that No Child Left Behind really brought to the forefront that was important.
Right.
Prior to No Child Left Behind, the states who were doing using high-stakes tests for accountability generally asked schools for their total student population to reach a certain pass rate. But they only looked at the total student population. What No Child Left Behind said is, yes, you must look at your total school population, but you must also look at the different demographic groups in your school separately. And when we did that, it really shined the light on the fact that we are not serving groups of students well. We're not serving our students of color well. We're not serving our students who with English not as their native language. We're not serving students with disabilities well. We're not serving students from poverty well. And No Child Left Behind helped to shine the light on that. And while that's generated a lot of conversation, what hasn't happened is any closing of the gap. We're not getting better by the measures we use, by these high-stakes tests. We're not getting better at serving those students that we identified as not being served well.
Do you think we can be better?
Oh, I know we can be better. There are models out there now that some might call new, but that they actually go back better than 100 years themselves. This idea of deeper learning is an idea that's getting a lot of traction in terms of conversation in education today. And it's really about engaging students through project-based learning. It's asking us to focus on the higher level thinking for students, as opposed to the recall that gets measured mostly on our multiple choice test. It calls for student agency, where students get some choice and control over their learning, over what they're learning, over how they're learning it, which currently, with the system we have in place, that's nearly impossible to do. It also encourages involving students in authentic work, work that is relevant to them, that's relevant to their communities in which they live. And of course, today, what technology allows us to do to not leverage the technology in learning would be almost criminal.
If someone made the argument, I'm sorry, teachers are feeling so constrained from their more creative and loving impulses in the classroom, but this is very important stuff. We really need them to be hitting that bar of getting every child in the classroom up to speed on these standards of learning that each state has come up with as necessary to sort of demonstrating uniform accomplishment on the part of students. You would say what?
I would say that we can do it without the high stakes testing mentality that we have in place. First of all, these schools that have embraced deeper learning, and we've got numerous models around the country who have, even without focusing on the test, as the vast majority of our schools do right now, even without focusing on that, without teaching content in isolation, without doing practice tests every 6 weeks, they are actually scoring as well, if not better, on the state test. The problem is that we have so few of these schools around. There is a network of schools called the New Tech Network, but there's only about 120,000 students across the country who are in New Tech Network schools, where we've got 50 million students in our schools around the country. So what we have to figure out how to do is to scale up these pockets of excellence that are taking place right now. But that's hard to do because we've created a problem for ourselves. To go into a school now and say, let's forget doing all the things we've been doing the last decade to pass the test, and we're going to try this really new that you're going to enjoy teaching more, the kids are going to be invested in, and the outcomes are going to be great. Will you go with me? That's a hard sell.
Yeah.
That's a hard sell. Yeah, because if it flops, we're going to get that label, failing school. If it flops, I'm going to get that label, failing teacher.
How can those of us who are not teachers support teachers as they enter another pandemic year, another unprecedented year?
Yes, the work that teachers have done this past year is absolutely unbelievable. To have been asked to learn new technologies, to teach remotely, to simultaneously teach a group of children who are in front of you, while also teaching a group of children who are in Zoom on your computer screen, is just unimaginable. And if we go back to the beginning of the pandemic, when schools were first closed, and on a dime, teachers made changes and made adjustments and provided packets of work, provided online opportunities, who visited homes and delivered meals, who did all of these things, through social media and otherwise, you saw almost a universal praising of teachers, where the public reached out and gave teachers that hug, gave them that pat on the back. And teachers can go a long way on a pat on the back and a recognition that they are working hard and that they are doing important work. But they get far too little of that. Any problem in education immediately gets blamed on the teachers. The stress of high-stakes testing on families and children, it gets blamed on teachers, and teachers have nothing to do with that decision. These are decisions actually that are not even made by educators. These are decisions made by state and federal legislation. So reaching out to teachers and saying, I see what you're doing and I appreciate it. I know you're putting in extra effort. I know you're reaching into your own pocket to buy school supplies for your kids. I know you're working Saturday and Sunday to be ready to teach next week. That would go a long way into helping teachers feel more satisfied with their work.
Do you also think that, ironically, with the pandemic and the loss of high-stakes testing in that first year of schools being closed down, that perhaps the system is changing, that we are reducing the need for high-stakes testing as a consequence of how the pandemic is changing schooling?
I'm not sure what all states did, but in Virginia, when we closed schools in March of 2020, we did not administer the test that spring. But throughout last year, when schools were open and closed and open again and remote and hybrid, we still tested our students in the spring. We went right back to testing. And in fact, for this year, we're adding in an additional test. We're going to start doing fall testing in reading and math in addition to spring testing.
If you had one final appeal to lawmakers on both sides of the aisle in all states who have some control over this and at the national level, what would you ask them to consider?
What is the purpose of our education system? When we look at profiles of a graduate, when we look at school mission statements, we see the language there. We know what people want out of schools, but that's not the schools. We don't have schools designed to do that. Most states in the country now have what's called a profile of a graduate, where they kind of lay out, here's what a student should look like when they leave our schools. And they're all lofty, wonderful ideals. We focus on what's called the five C's: critical thinking, creative thinking, communication, collaboration, and civic mindedness. All of those are great things. That's what we say we want our students to have when they leave, but we don't measure that. We measure isolated chunks of content through 50-question multiple choice test. I would encourage those legislatures, members of legislature, to go look at these pockets